Chapter 59. 2 days after the burial, and with the walkers still sleepwalking through the aftermath, Murray finally forced himself down to the basement to go through Sully's things. His laptop and cell phone were on the ping-pong table, untouched. Murray didn't have the heart to try and access them, and he didn't know the passcodes anyway. He didn't want to know what secrets, if any, they held. He did know that Sully had been spending more time on social media. After the first round upset of Duke, back on March 17th, Sully's fame spread like crazy and he was the talk of the sports world. His Facebook followers went from 20,000 to 400,000 in a matter of days. He posted more photos, chatted with his fans, and shared insights into the tournament. As Central advanced and became the epicenter of March Madness, his numbers skyrocketed. By the time the team traveled to Phoenix for the Final Four and Sullymania was raging, over 5 million fans liked his page. They followed the draft closely, and he played to his audience. His shocking death left everyone clamoring for more, and the number doubled. Murray looked at his page almost daily, but the brokenhearted messages from his fans were often too much to read. Emotions were simply too raw. He would swear off, leave the page, but return the next day for a quick look. He went through Sully's backpack and rifled through a pile of notebooks and sports magazines. In a daily planner that had been rarely used, Murray found some notes that were intriguing. Stapled to one page was a business card for a company called Aegis Partners and an advisor named Gary Gaston. He opened his own laptop and a quick search revealed little about the outfit. It was based in Bethesda and advertised itself as a player in the vague field of international security. On the back of the business card, Gaston had evidently scribbled his cell phone number. Murray called it, and a voice curtly answered, Gaston. Murray explained who he was and what he was doing and was surprised when Gaston said, Oh, I knew Sully pretty well. Even met him once just a few days ago when you guys were in D.C. looking for an apartment. Murray was surprised and said, I didn't know that. You were taking a nap and I went to your hotel. The Hyatt, met Sully in the bar, and we hit it off. Mind if I ask you why you were talking to Sully? Well, first, I'm very sorry about what has happened. It's quite a shock, and I'm sure you guys are reeling right now. We are. I was Sully's closest friend, and I never heard him mention you or your company. We're very private. That's our business. We do a lot of work in Africa. Complicated stuff I can't go into, but from time to time, we're hired to extricate people and bring them here. Extricate? That's it. Sully was convinced he was about to make some money. I guess he was right about that. And he wanted to hire us to get his family out of the refugee camp in Uganda. And how do you do that? Look, I prefer to avoid the phone as much as possible. Same for email and texts. Everything leaves a trail. Okay. I notice that your firm's website doesn't say much about your firm. We don't advertise, okay? Sully found us through a nonprofit that works with refugees. He knew them all, didn't he? I guess he did. So, you can't tell me anything? Sure I can, but not over the phone. If you want a cup of coffee, I'm happy to explain things. When can we meet? Gaston put him on hold for a moment, then said, Day after tomorrow work for you? Sure. When and where? I don't know. Look, I'd like to help. I really like the kid. Watch the draft and all. Love college basketball. And I was excited about doing the job. I have some time. Let's meet halfway and have lunch. When and where? Looks like Charlottesville is 3 hours for you. About the same for me. My wife is from the area, so let's meet there. Day after tomorrow? Over dinner, Murray briefed his parents, who, given his recent history of unexpected trips, were skeptical. But he had little else to do, now that his job as a manager was over, and he was not to be denied. He drove 3 hours to Charlottesville and met Gaston at an outdoor cafe on the downtown pedestrian mall. To his pleasant surprise, Gaston was African-American, about 50, and instead of the black suit Murray expected, He wore a gray designer jogging suit with state-of-the-art Adidas sneakers. The air was hot, but their table was in the shade. They ordered iced tea and salads, and Gaston began talking. He was a graduate of the Naval Academy and had spent a career in military intelligence before joining Aegis a few years earlier. Without much background about what the company did or did not do, he said he knew Africa quite well, had traveled throughout the continent, and had many contacts. Murray went through a windy narrative of how he met Sully and the delightful year they had just been through. Gaston seemed to know many of the details, especially about the season. He said, "The contract was reported to be worth $14 million. Don't suppose Sully got his hands on any of the money, did he?"
"No.
He had not even seen the contract. His agent said it would take about a month after the draft. That's all history now."
"Too bad.
Everything about it is tragic. You used the word extricate? Can we talk about that?"
"Sure. We were putting together a plan, and Sully was excited about it."
"How was it going to work?"
The salads arrived, and they began eating. Gaston said, "First, we were to arrange paperwork for his mother and brothers. Ugandan passports, visas, applications for entry into the U.S., basic stuff. We'd make arrangements with certain people in the Ugandan government to sort of look the other way. Not surprisingly, they're not at all hesitant to get rid of some refugees. They're trying to feed 1 million, and the number keeps growing. We'd facilitate their removal from the camp, take them to Kampala, give them nicer clothes and new identities, and put them on a plane bound for the U.S.
"Easy enough?"
"Easy enough if there's plenty of money. The most expensive part is the air transportation. Commercial flights won't work because there are no non-stop flights between Kampala and here. You have to stop and change planes. Stops mean more nosy people in customs asking for paperwork. We had a failure last year that has turned into a mess."
Murray took a bite and waited for more.
"Care to talk about that?"
"Briefly. We had a project involving a Somalian family living in a refugee settlement in Kenya. Their relatives here scraped together some money, and we decided to try it. It was a mistake. The family could not afford a private jet. No one can, unless, of course, someone in the family happens to sign a big NBA contract. Anyway, we got the family out of the camp, got them on a commercial flight from Nairobi to London. British immigration can be tough, and they stopped them at Heathrow. Their phony paperwork was discovered. All hell broke loose. The family is now stuck somewhere in the UK in custody and will probably be sent back to Somalia, where they will not be safe. Needless to say, that was our last project involving commercial air travel."
"How does the private jet work?"
"Well, it's a 7,000-mile trip that takes between 13 and 15 hours, depending on wind, weather, stuff like that. There is only one jet with that range, a Gulfstream G650.
I've been on a Gulfstream, thanks to Sully, of course.
Most Gulfstreams don't have the range. It has to be a G650.
"How much does the flight cost?"
$350,000.
$350,000?
"Yep. Roughly 30 hours in the air, terminal to terminal, at $10,000 an hour. Plus 4 pilots, expenses, profit. It adds up quickly. The entire trip takes 4 to 5 days if everything goes smoothly. And few charter companies want to go to Africa."
"Would the charter company know the real story?"
"No. Our documents are really good. That other story notwithstanding. Their pilots would have copies of the passports and ID cards, but once Sully's family was cleared by Uganda customs, then they'd have been home free. Until they arrived here."
"What would happen here?"
"Well, Murray, that's where Miss Ida would step in." Murray almost laughed. He shook his head in disbelief and asked,
"How do you know my mother?"
"Sully thought of everything. He knew that she could handle U.S. immigration. When the plane landed in Raleigh, the family would surrender to immigration, same as hundreds do each day at the borders. They'd be detained and taken into custody. She would immediately seek asylum, get an expedited hearing, and get them released and placed in a nice house pending their trial, which could take months."
Murray was still shaking his head.
"What would happen to the charter company? I mean, surely they would get in trouble."
"Probably, but we were counting on a small fine. Again, we were hoping Miss Ida could deal with immigration,
Since the amount of the fine is unknown, it was the one figure we weren't sure of.
So how much was the entire operation?
$500,000. As I said, virtually no one can afford it. We're talking about refugees and their families, folks who have nothing.
That's a lot of money.
It is. It takes some cash to grease the skids in Uganda. There are other expenses, and my time is valuable. I have to make the trip to guarantee everything works well.
Might I ask if your company has pulled off any of these extractions?
2, but I can't go into details. Let's just say they involved wealthy Syrian families here who wanted their people out of the camps.
So this is not your primary line of work?
Oh, no. We deal mainly with hostages and kidnappings. We rescue people and get them out. Unfortunately, kidnapping is big business in the developing world, and we have some expertise.
Murray shoved his salad away and said,
It sounds as if this extricating business requires a fair amount of criminal activity.
Gaston smiled and took a sip of iced tea. Depends on how you define it. If you want to laugh, go online and search fake passports. You'll see 100 sites brazenly advertising the preparation and sale of fake passports. That's a crime. We buy them all the time, so yes, in one sense, we're breaking the law, but there's little harm and almost no enforcement. And I'm sure that somewhere in Uganda there's a law on the books that prohibits the bribing of customs officials, or maybe there's not. At any rate, it's a way of life in the Third World. It's simply how business is done. Sully understood this and was willing to take his chances. His hands wouldn't get dirty. He would pay our fee, and we would take care of the rest.
Murray marveled at the extent of Sully's planning, and without a word to his roommate.
I can't believe he didn't tell me about this.
It was happening pretty fast. He made contact with me about 2 weeks before the draft, when it looked like he would indeed go in the first round. The money was almost within his grasp.
He would have told you eventually because he needed Miss Ida.
I guess so.
He was a smart guy.
Very smart. And very determined. We were excited about helping Sully because, obviously, he had the money. Or at least the prospect of it.
That's what he dreamed about. Getting his mother and brothers over here.
I'm sorry we can't help, Murray. Those poor folks will spend years in that camp, won't they?
Probably so. And Sully can't help him.
I assume his mother has heard the news?
Yes, some aid workers in the camp told her.
That poor woman.
She'll never know how close she came.
Mind if I ask what happened in the Bahamas?
Murray shrugged and said,
He had a bad night. Got some pills from a girl. Sully wasn't a user, not even close. He didn't smoke pot until the season was over, and then he didn't like it. He'd have a few beers, nothing more. It's so sad. He was a great guy.
He was. I'm very sorry.
Thanks.
And thanks for your time.
Gaston paid for lunch.
They shook hands and promised to keep in touch.
Chapter 60 Murray took as much time as possible driving back to Durham. He was in an even worse funk, and the thought of spending another night with his parents in a gloomy household was not appealing. Over dinner, he described his trip to Charlottesville and the lunch with Gary Gaston. They were amazed at Sully's plans to extricate his family, big plans that had not been shared with them. July 4th came and went with no hint of a celebration around the Walker home. Jordan was there for a few days, but not even she could lift their spirits. On July 6th, Murray drove to Charlotte, where the first round of the International Showcase was being held. Echo would be there with his latest installment of young South Sudanese talent. Central's new head coach, Jason Grinnell, would be there, along with Lonnie Britt, no doubt watching Echo's players more closely and hoping to discover another star. He found them at the Spectrum Center, home of the Hornets, and they invited him to the coach's suite to hang out with their friends. There was a lot of talk about Central's miracle run to the Final Four, and Murray enjoyed the attention. That night, over a long dinner with the three coaches, they tried hard to talk about anything but Sully. It didn't work. All four men were deeply wounded and still stunned by the loss. Each took turns telling stories of how friends and strangers had reached out to them and offered to help. Sully had thrilled the basketball world and touched many people, many of whom were still eager for some connection to the kid and his remarkable story. Jason Grinnell said that the central program had received over $50,000 in small gifts from fans everywhere. Echo's program had also received many small gifts to support players in South Sudan. He said, "Sully still has millions of followers on social media. I check it all the time, and some of the comments almost make me cry." Jason said, "I tried to look too, but it's overwhelming." Echo said, "Here's an idea, Murray. You should try to capitalize on Sully's popularity. Why don't you consider starting a foundation in his name with the proceeds going to something like humanitarian relief for our people?" Lonnie added, "Great idea. I'll bet you could raise a fortune." Jason said, "And how about a few bucks for dear old Central?" Murray said, "How do you start a foundation?" Echo said, "It's easy. Everybody's got a foundation. The one I work for has some lawyers who'll guide you through it. All you need is a mission statement, a cool website, and somebody to run it. It doesn't have to be fancy. Post a link on Sully's social media, and I'll bet you get an amazing response." "Don't you need IRS approval?" Lonnie asked. "Sure, but you can get started as that is pending," Echo replied. "I've heard the lawyers talk about it. I'll bet your mother knows the ropes. Her legal aid is a nonprofit, right?" "Oh, yeah. You never hear them talk about profits." "What's the mission?" Lonnie said. "It could be threefold. First, humanitarian relief for refugees. Second, to support youth basketball in South Sudan. Third, to raise money for scholarships in Sully's name at Central." Echo said, "The three of us can serve on your board, along with anyone else you want. We'll see how much money comes in and decide how to give it away." Jason smiled and whistled and said, "This could be huge." For the first time in memory, Murray arose early the next morning and hustled back to Durham. He bought sandwiches and took them to Ida's office for a working lunch. Typically, she was skeptical of any idea or scheme that tried to profit off Sully's name. He objected to the word profit, and she apologized, saying she had used the word carelessly. Of course, there were no thoughts about making money. She had not seen him so engaged and excited since he and Sully had returned from the draft in New York. She suggested that they discuss it with Ernie over dinner and sleep on it. That was all the approval Murray needed. Borrowing from the funds that Sully had borrowed from Arnie, a loan that so far had not been mentioned by the agent, Murray spent $4,000 on a website design, $2,500 on legal advice, and $2,000 on a 19-year-old kid who ran his own company specializing in online marketing. He opened a bank account, rented a post office box, and read with discomfort the proposed bylaws and IRS regs sent over by the lawyer. On July 19th, 1 month to the day after that horrible Sunday morning at the Acropolis, the Sully Fund was launched. The website featured a beautiful color sketch taken from Murray's favorite photo of his friend. There was Sully, with the ball held high over his head and a wicked smile on his face, soaring high above the rim for another rattling dunk. There were photos of the refugee settlements, the starving children, of healthier teenagers playing basketball on dirt courts, and a tribute to the great Central team that had so captivated the sports world. The website and social media pages were linked to each other in every way possible. By midnight of launch day, over 50,000 viewers had visited the site, and 11,000 had sent money, a total of $148,000. Murray forced himself to close his laptop, and he tried to sleep. By noon the next day, the money was at $305,000, and the deluge was on. The fund was going viral. Sully's popularity was astonishing. His tragic death only heightened the public's desire to help in some small way. The comments and condolences were overwhelming and poured in with the money. After 72 hours, more than 100,000 people had paid by credit card, with the average gift at about $8.
After 4 days, the fund topped $1 million, and Murray was giving interviews. He sent a long memo to his board, Echo, Lonnie, Jason, and Ida, and described in detail Sully's desire to extricate his family and his plans for doing so. With the board's approval, he called Gary Gaston. Chapter 61. 3 weeks later, Gaston arrived at the Walker home for a pre-flight briefing. He brought with him an African-American woman named Sylvia, who he described as one of his associates. She specialized in extrication logistics, something as vague as Gaston could possibly make it sound, but the Walkers were not about to ask for any clarification. A week earlier, Gaston had explained to Murray that a woman would be a nice addition to the team, because Beatrice and the boys might feel more comfortable around her. They were likely to be thoroughly rattled, if not traumatized, and women handled those situations better. There was some loose talk about Ida making the trip, though she was not keen to go. That talk got nixed when Gaston explained that he and Murray, along with whatever woman they took, would run the slight risk of getting arrested upon their entry into the U.S. The charge could be aiding and abetting an illegal entry. Gaston was prepared to risk such a minor charge. Murray was undaunted. Ida preferred not to be arrested and flatly said no. She needed to stay behind and organize the legal team and deal with immigration. Gaston said with two prior extrications, both involving Syrians, the planes landed in Bangor, Maine, where immigration was not known to be as aggressive as, say, Miami. The families surrendered to the authorities were detained, and immigration never pursued anyone for aiding and abetting. Over dinner at Ida's table, Gaston walked them through each step of the extrication and answered all their questions. He showed them the forged passports for the Sulaimans. Using photos that Echo had taken with them in December, the forger had done what appeared to be a masterful job of producing Ugandan passports. Since Suleiman was a familiar name throughout East Africa, and Beatrice, James, and Chol were not uncommon, their new passports used their real names. Murray had been able to obtain their birth dates from Echo. Gaston expanded on the story he had told Murray about the failed extrication a year earlier at Heathrow. The paperwork had been fine, but the immigration official became suspicious when the mother flubbed her fictitious birth date. Ernie wanted to know what could go wrong. Several things that they knew of and several that no one had ever heard of. The biggest fear was the airplane. The Gulfstream 650 had a range of 7,500 miles, and Entebbe was 7,300 miles from the airport at Raleigh-Durham. Flying west, they would certainly face headwinds, and if they were strong enough, the jet might be forced to make a pit stop. Landing anywhere but the U.S. was risky. However, the pilots would monitor the weather closely and would know what they were facing before they took off. Plan B would be to land in the Canary Islands, a favorite fueling stop for international flights and a place known for customs agents who could be convinced to look the other way. Gaston had contacts there. There was always the chance that trouble might erupt at Rhino Camp South and prevent a quiet exit by Beatrice and the boys. There were other risks, but on the whole, Gaston and Sylvia were confident. After they said goodnight and left for their hotel, Murray went to his room and finished packing. As he did almost every hour, he checked in with the fund, now at over $3 million and counting. He had been forced to hurriedly hire a part-time secretary to deal with the details and make sure the donors, all 265,000 of them, were properly thanked. Their systems were upgraded. More powerful software was added. Murray was chasing his tail and in need of full-time help, and the last thing he needed was a trip to Uganda. But he wasn't about to miss the adventure. Before they were buckled in, the co-pilot welcomed them aboard and briefed them on the flight. Thanks to a tailwind, their estimated flight time was only 13 hours. 13 sounded only slightly better than 14 or 15. Just minutes before their scheduled 11 a.m. departure, the flight attendant took their drink orders and handed them lunch menus. The jet seemed plated with gold. The leather recliners were soft and deep. The carpet was thick, plush. A mahogany dining table sat midway aft, and beyond it were two sofas that folded into beds,
complete with silk sheets. Screens were everywhere, and there was an endless selection of movies and channels. It would be Murray's third trip on a private jet, and something told him it would probably be his last. Classes started in 2 weeks, and it was back to the grind. Then basketball, without Sully and without Coach Britt, and a season that looked less than promising. Murray found a chair in the rear, kicked off his shoes, buckled himself in, and vowed to enjoy the trip. The two soldiers were Ugandan defense forces, the usual troops seen around the camp. They wore the standard green fatigues, shiny black boots, smart black berets, and, as always, had cowlies strapped over their shoulders. They found Beatrice behind her tent, tending to her small plot of vegetables. They were friendly and polite, and asked her to step away for a private word. They informed her that she had been selected to move to a newer section of Rhino Camp South, to a nicer home. Keep it quiet. She had heard the rumors of new housing to replace their rotting tents, but those rumors had been around for months. The refugees spent half their time sifting through rumors, or creating more of them. They returned to her tent, where a third soldier was waiting with two army duffel bags. Beatrice balked and said she wasn't sure she wanted to leave. Her close friends lived on each side of her, and she wouldn't go without them. The soldiers smiled and said her friends would make the move tomorrow. Within minutes, she had packed everything she owned, clothing, blankets, pillows, tins of food, some notebooks from school, and two plastic jugs for hauling water. The soldiers carried the duffels as they left the area. Beatrice looked back at her tent, her home for the past year, and wondered if she would ever see it again. An army jeep was waiting. The soldiers helped Beatrice into the front passenger seat and tossed her bags into the back where another soldier was sitting. The jeep weaved slowly through the settlement and came to its edge, near the school. Standing in front, under the shade of a tree, was a teacher with James and Cho. Beatrice asked the driver, "Why are we getting the boys?"
"We have a surprise. You'll like it."
The boys squeezed into the back seat of the jeep and waved to their teacher. They had never been in a jeep before. In fact, they could barely remember their last ride in a motorized vehicle, the old pickup owned by their uncle in Lota. Their rides would only continue to be upgraded. As they left Rhino, Beatrice was concerned. Again, she asked the driver,
"Where are we going?"
"To Kampala, then to America."
She was stunned and speechless. They rode for almost an hour over a busy, wide gravel road, dodging supply trucks and troop carriers. At the airport, a small Ugandan Air Force cargo plane was waiting as another one landed and taxied to the warehouse. In the rear seat, the soldier asked the boys,
"Ever been up in an airplane before?"
They shook their heads no and watched wide-eyed as the jeep stopped next to the cargo plane. Beatrice had never considered air travel, and thus had no opinions about whether or not it was for her. However, at the moment, she was stricken with fear and didn't want to leave the jeep. The soldiers gently coaxed her out with promises of safe travel and a visit to the big city before leaving for America. Once inside, they strapped her in, the boys too, and wished them well. The two engines sputtered to life, and the old plane shook itself. Two cool pilots in aviator shades turned around, smiled at them, and gave them thumbs up. Beatrice was too stiff to move, but the boys were grinning from ear to ear. Murray, Gaston, and Sylvia were lounging under a wide umbrella by the pool, sipping drinks with no alcohol, and waiting for the second day in a row. In the bush, the best-laid plans often go awry, and the delay was being blamed on some confusion regarding cargo planes. It didn't matter, and it wasn't a big deal. Delays were always expected. There were worse ordeals than hanging around Kampala Serena, a 5-star hotel in the middle of the commercial district. Gaston's phone rang, and he got to his feet. He said, "1 hour. Great." He put the phone away and nodded at Murray and Sylvia. They went to their rooms, changed, and returned to the lobby, where they waited. The family arrived in a white van with no military markings, proof that immigration had now taken over. The driver was an officious-looking man in a suit. He slid open the side door and helped Beatrice to the pavement. The boys followed, and all three stood frozen, unsure of what to say or do, or where to go. The Serena Hotel was a vast and beautiful building, and they had just driven through the chaos and congestion of a big city, their first ever. Gaston stepped forward and said, "We represent your American family. We're here to take you home." Murray smiled at the boys and said, "I'm Murray. I lived with your brother and he was my best friend." They immediately recognized him from the videos Samuel had sent. They awkwardly shook his hand. As they entered the lobby, the always courteous doorman smiled and then exchanged looks. Three well-dressed Americans and three bewildered and somewhat ragged refugees from the bush. It came as no surprise that the boys wanted lunch. They had never eaten in a restaurant before, neither had Beatrice. And once their bags were checked in, they followed Gaston to a corner table where they could talk. And talk they did. As Beatrice realized that they were indeed headed to America, she had many questions. The boys asked Murray what they should eat, and he ordered cheeseburgers and sodas. And of course, they wanted to talk about Samuel. For people who had slept last night on the floor of a tent, and every night for the past year, and who had spent hours each day waiting in endless lines for food, and who had lost half their family and all hope in the future, and who had no idea why they had been plucked from the camp, the moment was simply overwhelming. Beatrice cried a lot, and then she laughed, and ate, and tried her best to understand Murray as he tried his best to explain how a nonprofit worked in the U.S. He finally gave up and said, "Let's just say that Samuel is responsible for this." After a long lunch, they escorted the family to their large room with two beds. Murray showed them how to work the shower and toilet. From the balcony, he pointed below to the beautiful pool and told the boys he would take them swimming as soon as they changed. Gaston called the front desk and organized a van to take them shopping, and he and Sylvia left with Beatrice to buy new clothes. It was imperative that the family, now full-fledged Ugandans, looked the part of well-documented immigrants headed for America. If a customs agent somewhere checked their luggage, he would find some nice new clothes and nothing out of the ordinary. And new clothes were certainly needed. Staying clean in the camps was impossible, and the dirt and grime had become part of the fabrics. In the pool, Murray marveled at how skinny James and Chol were. They were already tall for their ages, 11 and 13, and he could almost count their ribs. He had never seen kids so thin in America. As they frolicked in the water, he watched closely for the slightest hint or sign that they shared the same marvelous DNA as their brother. They could not swim, so they stayed in the shallow end, and as he listened to them chatter and play, he remembered many wonderful stories Sully had told about his little brothers. He said James looked just like him, and he was right. He said Chol would be the best basketball player in the family. They would soon see about that. Water became the topic. Water in the pool, water in the tub, but especially water from the tap that ran nonstop and they could drink all they wanted. The boys took shower after shower, and Murray didn't have the heart to tell them that in Durham there would be a monthly water bill. When they were bored with the shower, they returned to the pool. Murray recalled that the team managers had been amazed at how little water Sully consumed. After another fine meal at dinner, they met in Gaston's room to walk through tomorrow's schedule. So far, each leg had gone as planned. Gaston often smiled at how far a little cash could go in the developing world. Cash under the table certainly worked back home as well. It just took more of it. Chapter 62. Ida believed the optimum time to land at Raleigh-Durham International was around 2 or 3 in the afternoon. Though she had been negotiating with Immigration and Customs Enforcement and thought they had an understanding, she knew from experience that things could go wrong. She might need an hour or so to run to immigration court, where a judge was on standby. They left the hotel in the same van at 4 a.m. and drove an hour to the airport at Entebbe. Gaston thanked the driver and tipped him heavily. He'd been tipping a lot in Kampala. A woman with the same sense of authority as Ida Walker met them at the General Aviation Terminal and led them inside. The word Customs was embroidered above the pocket of her shirt, and she seemed to own the place. It was deserted, and there was little traffic in this corner of the sprawling airport. She collected all 6 passports, pointed to a pot of coffee in a corner, and disappeared. On the tarmac, their beautiful jet was glistening in the lights as the pilots went through the pre-flight routines. James and Chol wore matching khaki shorts, white golf shirts, and white socks and sneakers. Beatrice had found a bright yellow gomesi, the floor-length traditional dress of Ugandan women. She would have preferred something from her own country, but for the moment, she was pretending to be Ugandan. At any rate, the three looked adorable and gave every indication of being a prosperous family headed to a new adventure in the United States. Without asking for their ID cards, the customs official brought the passports back, stamped, and ready to go. 2 men in uniforms scanned the bags and put them on a cart to be pushed to the jet. Clearing customs took less than 15 minutes. On board, Murray introduced the family to the flight attendant, a person he now knew well. She situated them in a club area with 4 large chairs and asked what they wanted to drink. Of course, the boys were hungry, and they were soon talking about breakfast. James, the clown in a spitting image of Samuel, said to Murray that this plane was a bit nicer than the Ugandan cargo twin they had used the day before. Murray showed the boys around, stepping around the feet of the adults, and promised that they could watch as many movies as they wanted over the next 15 hours. At 2 p.m. Eastern Time, Ida and her team gathered in the lobby of the private terminal at Raleigh-Durham International. She had 2 lawyers from her office with her, and she asked Tyler Guy, Sully's pro bono immigration lawyer, to join them as well. Ida had been working with the International Rescue Committee, and Ms. Kaiser was on hand. She had met Samuel the previous September. 4 ICE officers arrived, and things were immediately tense. Ida managed to lighten the mood with some banter, but the ICE boys were not easy to mollify. They had a job to do, to arrest and detain people caught entering the country illegally. When the Gulfstream landed at 2:10, it was directed to a place on the tarmac 50 yards from the terminal. By the time its engines were cut off, 3 ICE SUVs were waiting, all with as many flashing blue lights as possible. On board, Sylvia sat with Beatrice and the boys and tried to reassure them. She said, "I know we've been through this before, but there's no way around what's about to happen. You will be arrested and taken away, but you won't be locked up for long. Whatever you do, smile and be polite to the agents. They're just doing their jobs." Now that reality had hit home, Murray had a knot in his stomach. Why go to all the trouble of sneaking in refugees if they're just going to be arrested? But he knew his mother was in charge. Gaston collected the fake passports and ID cards from the family and said, "Just keep smiling. Everything is going to be fine." 10 minutes passed, then 15. Ida and her team watched nervously from inside the terminal. Finally, the jet's door opened and ICE agents walked up the steps. 10 more minutes passed. Ida had been promised that she would be allowed to speak to the family before they were taken away. Finally, Murray appeared and was followed down the steps by Sylvia, then James, Chol, Beatrice, Gary Gaston, then the ICE agents. The 3 were not handcuffed and were led into the terminal, where Ida stepped forward and said,
"Welcome, Beatrice. I'm Samuel's American mother, and I'm delighted to meet his real one."
They embraced and kissed on both cheeks, and Ida was struck by how tall Beatrice was. Murray introduced James and Chol, and for a few awkward moments, they chatted and welcomed them to American soil. As promised, the ICE agents then, rather gently, handcuffed all 3 and led them away. They were driven to a federal detention facility near Raleigh, where Beatrice was placed in a cell on the female floor. James and Chol were placed together in a juvenile wing. They knew a brief stint in jail was unavoidable, but it was still unsettling to be behind bars. James and Chol laughed at the fact that the night before they were hanging out in the luxurious Serena Hotel, while the night before that they had gone to sleep in their tent at Rhino Camp South. Compared to the tent, the cheap bunk beds in one corner of their cell didn't look so bad. U.S. law requires that any person who enters the country illegally and requests political asylum be detained by ICE for as short a time as possible before being brought before an immigration judge. At 10 the following morning, Ida and her team were waiting in the courtroom of the Honorable Stanley Furlow, a former intern at Legal Aid and a Central Law School graduate. Beatrice and the boys were brought in, all smiling, all wearing what they had worn on the plane. They spent a few minutes talking to their lawyers and getting oriented. Judge Furlow called their case and proceeded to separately ask all three the same basic questions. There were no real issues to contest, not at that point anyway. In a trial several months down the road, the government could argue that the three did not meet the requirements for asylum, but that was another fight for another day. Some paperwork was passed around, and the lawyers whispered to their clients. After about an hour, Judge Furlow ordered the family released to the custody of their sponsors, Ernie and Ida Walker, and a date for their trial would be set later. A small caravan left downtown Durham, and 10 minutes later turned onto a street near Central's campus. The house was one of three in a triplex. It was new and had been built by an affordable housing coalition in partnership with the city. Murray had kicked in some money from the Suley Fund. The home's exterior walls were a bright yellow and almost matched Beatrice's Gomesi. A crowd was already there. The IRC had rounded up a dozen South Sudanese refugees in the area and invited them to the open house. Most of Ida's staff was there, along with Ernie. Coach Grinnell and his wife had stopped by. When Beatrice and the boys walked up the sidewalk, the crowd clapped and yelled, "Welcome to your new home!" When they stepped inside and saw the furniture, the pretty pictures on the wall, the rugs, and a table covered with food, they were overcome. Late in the afternoon, long after the guests were gone, Ida asked Beatrice if she wanted to visit the cemetery. She replied that she was ready for it. The families took two cars and drove 10 minutes to Rustling Meadows Memorial Park, a modern-style cemetery without vaults and tombstones. All the graves were identical and were laid out in large, perfect half-moons that covered a long, rolling meadow. They parked by the chapel and walked along perfectly landscaped trails until they drew close. Ida stopped and pointed to a newer grave with red dirt and fresh flowers. Murray took James and Chol by the hand and led them closer. A new granite plaque read, "Samuel Suleiman, born August 11, 1997, died June 19, 2016. Both boys started to cry and wiped their cheeks. Murray backed away and watched as they each leaned on their mother. It was a heartbreaking scene, and neither Murray nor Ida nor anyone else could begin to imagine their pain. 2 days later, after work, Murray stopped by the house and collected James and Chol. He had told them to wear their new sneakers. He drove them to the campus and parked outside the nest in Coach Grinnell's reserved space. He proudly showed them his own key, opened the side door, and led them through the underground hallway until they emerged onto the court. They tried to absorb the place with its shiny wood floors, its thousands of maroon seats, its banners hanging from the ceiling. In one corner, there was a huge photo of Suley in action. Murray said, "This is where he played." They roamed around the floor, from one end to the other, trying to connect with the history left behind by their big brother. But they were too overwhelmed. Murray found a rack of balls and tossed out a couple. Chol was 13 and already pushing 6 feet. He bounced a ball twice, pulled up, and fired away from 20 feet. Nothing but net. Chapter 63. On a spectacular autumn day in early November, a small crowd gathered, by invitation only, in front of the McDougald McClendon Arena, also known as The Nest and the Home of the Eagles. Under an oak, and with a gentle breeze scattering leaves, they sat in folding chairs and waited for the unveiling. Next to a small podium was the reason they were there. Under a maroon and gray drape, there was obviously a work of art or piece of sculpture. The guests included all members of the current Eagles team, along with their coaches and managers, a dozen or so staff from the AD's office, another 10 from the president's, some student leaders, the Walker and Suleiman families, and some of their close friends, about 100 in all. A larger celebration had been discussed, but the brevity of the event dictated a smaller crowd. There was only one short speech. The president took the podium and began.
"Thank you for coming. This will not take long, but it will be something you will remember for a long time. We gather to honor the greatest hero in our school's history and to unveil a bronze image of him that will last forever. Suli arrived on this campus a year ago, an unknown student athlete who could not go home. This university gave him a scholarship and took him in. We had no idea what was coming. We freely gave to him and could not envision what he would give in return. He took us places we've never been and, frankly, never thought we would go. He played the game with an enthusiasm that was contagious, and he played it with a talent that grew with each game and reached heroic levels. We will never forget Suli, his big smile, his boyish excitement, his exuberant love of the game, and his intense loyalty to his teammates. We will never forget what he did for this university. Back in August, his roommate and best friend, Murray Walker, approached me with the idea of memorializing Suli with something permanent here on campus. We met with our art department and the ideas began. What you're about to see is a bronze image of the great Suli in action. It was commissioned by one of our own, Ronnie Kelso of Wilmington. I'll ask Suli's mother to come forward and do the honors. Ms. Beatrice Suleiman.
Across the street, a group of students stopped to watch. Others joined them. Beatrice stood in the front row and took 3 steps. The president handed her a small cord, which she pulled gently, and the draping fell to the ground. Everyone clapped politely as Beatrice admired the likeness. It was Suli, soaring through the air, the ball cocked high and ready for a dunk. At its base was a plaque that read, "Suli. In 2016, Suli played 20 games and became the most popular player in college basketball. He led the Eagles to the Final Four, and then he was gone. But he will always live in the hearts of those who saw him play." From across the street, the students began chanting, quietly and respectfully. "Suli, Suli, Suli." Author's note. When I was 13 years old, I sat mesmerized in the stands one night watching Pistol Pete Maravich score 40 points against the Ole Miss Rebels. He was amazing, cocky, unstoppable, and obviously immensely talented. His performance altered my life because from that moment on, I was determined to become a star just like him. I couldn't decide on an appropriate nickname, but I was certain the fans would settle on one. I shot buckets for hours, made the high school team, and dreamed of college recruiters lined up in the driveway. They never found our house. Around the age of 16, I realized that, as with baseball and football, my prodigious ability to dream was no match for my glaring lack of talent. So, like most ex-jocks, I finally called it quits and became an avid sports fan. Later in life, I decided that since I couldn't play the games, I might as well write about them. Thus, Bleachers, Playing for Pizza, Calico Joe, and now Suli. Special thanks to those who could play the game and eagerly passed along advice.
Barry Parkhill, Tony Bennett, Evan Nolte, and Lavelle Moten. Thanks also to Brian Kersey, Jack Gernert, John Montgomery, Alan Swanson, Neil Cassell, Talmadge Boston, and Kyle Serba at UNC Central. John Grisham, February 8th, 2021. This is Dion Graham. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Sully by John Grisham. This program was directed by Robert Kessler. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Recorded by Mike Bognar at CDM Studios. Edited by JSR Post, LLC. Text copyright 2021 by Belfry Holdings, Inc. Production copyright 2021, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved. Audible.